from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The list of movies Diane Keaton has appeared in is impressive indeed. The Godfather, Annie Hall, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Something's Gotta Give, The First Wives Club, and it goes on and on. And looking back at it, as Keaton does in a new memoir, she sounds happy about all of it. She also sounds a little bit sad about all of it. Happy because it was great, sad because she's at the point in life where there are more films made than she will make from now on, which is a mere function of age. And that's what she writes about, the repercussions of time, which she's still trying to figure out for herself. This point, this hour, On Point, a conversation with Diane Keaton. Later on this hour, a sports writer and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, remember, Maya Angelou. But joining me now from Culver City, California, is Diane Keaton, actor, director, producer, and author. She took home the Oscar and the Golden Globe for Annie Hall and a Golden Globe for Something's Gotta Give. Her 2011 memoir, Then Again, was a New York Times bestseller, and she is out with a new memoir, an update. Let's just say it wasn't pretty. That's the title. Diane Keaton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
It's a pleasure to have you on, and I have to admit to the fact that I'm a close reader.
Seriously.
Yeah, I'm a close reader of the book. I actually have read, underlined, and picked phrases out, some of which.
Would you say that the book is skewed more towards women than men?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think because probably I am a woman. I don't know if you noticed that, John, but
you refer to it repeatedly in the book, particularly
in the book, in the several
really, to me, very interesting things that you talk about woman-wise that I don't see showing up in books a lot. And that is
what's that?
A focus on the decline of the body.
The body. Oh, yes. Yes.
You talk about your impending baldness, and you talk about the gravitational pull on your backside and on your front side, and you're very while tastefully addressing it, you're very explicit about the fact that you're actually hating seeing the impact of age. And I found it curious.
Don't you think that all people feel that way, though, and they just kind of pretend like they don't?
Exactly. They do pretend that they don't.
In the morning and you're very well aware of the fact that you're not perfect. You're sort of wrong. And the wrong keeps getting more wrong as you get older because you're facing, of course, the end of life. You have to admit it. And that whole generation of mine, you know, the baby boomers, we simply have a very difficult time accepting that fact. And I am one of them. I refuse to accept the fact. I just feel like I've got to fight it every day. I've got to try my best.
And it did seem to take you by surprise.
I would say that it didn't really take me by surprise because it's a gradual process. I think that I was always, well aware of the flaws, and that's what the book is really, really dedicated to, women who can't seem to get to right without being a little wrong, which is something we should applaud, because I feel like just the recognition of the fact that you might be unusual in many ways is kind of a plus for you, because it gives you an incentive. It gives you an incentive to just kind of embrace some of them and make the best of them. That's what I like about women like, of course, Katharine Hepburn is a great example. Look at her, showing up, in a Chairman Mao's tunic at the Academy Award instead of a gown. People like that. I have to admire, or Diana Nyad, right, the distance swimmer at 63. I mean, people like that, or even like comics. Like, I am a fan of Joan Rivers, because to me she has a sense of humor about who she is and her attitude toward cosmetic surgery. I mean, she and Phyllis Diller early on went under the knife, as they used to call it back in the day, and had a lot of surgery done to their face to enhance it, to make it look younger. But they were courageous in this sense that they spoke about it then. And then it was really frowned upon. And I'm talking really about your late 50s, your early 60s, when all this, amazing things that people can do to themselves to prolong that youthful look was not accepted. So, I admired them. And I think that to have a sense of humor about your choices makes you still unique and individual and somebody that, for me anyway, I admire that.
But you're personally agnostic on the use of plastic surgery and not a practitioner.
At this point, I mean, I've had a lot of surgeries on my face with regards to skin cancer. So, you know, that's something that you need to cut out. But
right.
I haven't experienced it yet. But who's to say I won't? I mean, I'm a little long in the tooth to be trying now. It might not really work.
You write.
Think about what the consequences are.
You write this, and I really love this passage. Sometimes I wish I could talk to my contemporaries about how they're grappling with their senior years. Do they wake up every morning and, like me, look in the mirror with a big sigh? Do they? Do they ask themselves what old age is for? I do. And how do you answer it?
How do I answer it?
Mm-hmm.
I answer it by just embracing the fact that my eyes see. And for me, that may be the biggest gift of all, because
you mean that they're still working.
That I see the world. Mm-hmm. That, look, right now I'm in a booth, and it's a very strange experience. But there are aspects of it that you could say are worthy of just kind of being in the presence of, like this microphone in my face is something that I can see, and I appreciate that. And when you really look at it for a while, you start to see, well, look at all the detail that went into this, and there's something there, and also the idea of amplifying my sound. I mean, all these sensory gifts we've been given, just the fact that we're here on this planet, there's much to be grateful for.
This is living in the moment is what you're talking about.
Well, that's something that Sanford Meisner, our old acting teacher, way back in the day when I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse School of Theater in New York City, I was about 20, and I remember that he was always saying, live truthfully in the given imaginary moment. Now, he said imaginary moment, but I say erase the imaginary and just say live truthfully in the moment. Because if you do, you're going to see the most astonishing things that you can't even – but if you get walled in and you lose this sense of – and I do think, by the way, that as you get older, you have more of an opportunity to accept change and see it for what it is, which is kind of a miracle.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're sounding to me at the moment quite celebratory of this phase in life. And yet when I read the book, I had more of a sense of real winsomeness and regret about its passing. Not a regret about the things you've done, although you make clear there are some things you did, some things you wish you hadn't done, but I just mean about the passage of time, that it seems in the book to weigh on you. And listening to you now, I don't hear that at all.
It's the morning and I've had a cup of coffee and I've already had my little time to myself to regret some of the choices I've made or, you know, how I look in the mirror or things like that. But as, you know, we do get accustomed to the habit of being alive and the joys that are part of that. So now, instead of it being 4:30 in the morning, which I woke up at 4:30 a.m. in order to be here on time, I was told if I was not on time, it was going to be a disaster. So I am here on time. I was an hour early. In that hour, many things have changed. I met some really wonderful people here at NPR. We had a chat. So I'm feeling good. I'm really very pleased that I'm alive, and I'm very excited about just having this experience.
You write in the introduction to your book, your daughter Dexter, who's 18 or 19 now, coming across this website, 10 top 10 female celebrities who are ugly no matter what Hollywood says.
Yeah.
And this guy puts you at number 6 on the list.
That
has got to hurt.
In a way, but then if you think about the fact that I'm number 6 and Angelina Jolie is number 1,
right,
then you have to say I'm the luckiest woman in life, because isn't she one of the most beautiful women ever? As well as Reese Witherspoon, it's sort of, I'm not at all, actually, that didn't affect me in any way at all except to laugh, because, my God, I'm in such great company. Why would I complain? It's a perception of how you see what it is that you don't like about someone. I mean, obviously, when you stick your neck out there and you have a life in some way in the public eye, you're asking for that. And it comes with it. It's part of the territory and really fine.
And there's also this other side of the story.
That youthful glow? Oh, yeah. Now you can get it back.
From L'Oreal, the first ever facial oil. New Age Perfect Glow Renewal.
I got my glow back.
Mm-hmm. New from L'Oreal Paris. Age Perfect Glow Renewal.
Because we're worth it.
So you're a spokesperson for L'Oreal, which sounds to me as though a lot of people don't think you're among the top 10 ugliest celebrities in Hollywood, that you're doing just great.
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. I'm excited about life. I mean, I'm excited about, you know, things that I love. I like humor. I feel like, thank God for that, laughing. I talk about that in the book because with laughter, there's just so much release and it's so much of an appreciation. And I think that funny women like Melissa McCarthy, for example, to me, I think she's a comic genius. And she's so unusual to be a massive movie star, a box office, you know,
she's
a
an
blockbuster.
Original.
She's just astonishing. I saw The Heat over the summer and I just was going, what? I hadn't really been aware of her until I saw The Heat. And I just think she's great, you know, and Kristen Wiig and all these women who are funny, and that includes, you know, the Phyllis Dillers of the world too.
Right.
I think that humor is a part of beauty that we really also have to cherish, you know, and love and appreciate.
We are talking to Diane Keaton about Hollywood, living an authentic life, beauty, and aging, which I think we've done with now. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking to Diane Keaton, and we have people lined up, Diane, who would love to chat with you. So let's.
Do you mind? You know, if I would just read a little excerpt from the book that I think addresses some of the things you were asking me about loss and being older.
Did you pick something out over the break?
Please
go ahead.
Because I brought my book. This is, you know, I was making this movie with Rob Reiner last summer, and Michael Douglas was starring in it, and it's called And So It Goes. And, you know, I had to shoot this final scene by myself, and I play Leah, and Leah is a 65-year-old wannabe lounge singer, right? And you can imagine what that is. Anyway, and she's fallen in love with Michael Douglas's character, and they'd kissed, and they'd even had sex, and but kind of feeling pressured, you know, Oren, that's the name of Michael's character, had abandoned Leah. So I was alone, and I was about to sing by myself because everyone was saying goodbye, like I told you before, and I had to sing The Shadow of Your Smile. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, John, but anyway. And then the crew members were all saying goodbye as they set up the shot, and I knew that I had to break down. I had to cry. And I didn't know, you know, I was filled with all this anxiety, kind of like this morning talking to you. And I told Rob, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders because, I mean, really, what could he do? I mean, you know. So before action, he had one direction to me, and it was cry. So there I was, and the cameras were on me, and suddenly I was sitting on a bar stool, and I was speaking into a microphone. And these were the words that I had to say from the script, and I say, the next song has a special meaning for me. I was 17, and this song was playing when I realized that I was in love for the first time. Hmm. And that first time is so powerful, you can't imagine ever having those feelings for anyone else. But sometimes life outlives love. I never thought I'd love again, but here I am, still singing this song, still dreaming of love. And that's when I started to sing, you know, the words to The Shadow of Your Smile, which go like this. I started singing, "The shadow of your smile, when you are gone, will color all my dreams and light the dawn." And when I got to "our wistful little star was far too high, a teardrop kissed your lips, and so did I." I forgot that I was making a movie in Connecticut. I forgot that the camera was pushing in on my face. I forgot about the audience of extras. And you know what? I don't really know why. but I began to cry. Now when I remember spring and all the joy that love can bring, I will be remembering the shadow of your smile. And you know, John, it was only then that I, Diane, realized that it was the recognition that sometimes life does outlive love, right?
Yeah.
And it was the regret of thinking that, oh my God, maybe I'm never going to love again or see the color of my dreams light the dawn. But it was also knowing that in spite of everything, to simply still be singing a song and still be dreaming of love was enough.
Point made.
For me.
And I could hear you connect to that. Let's bring in Beth from Exeter, New Hampshire. Beth, hi.
Okay.
Beth, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you.
Yes?
Hi, Diane and John.
Hi.
Hi. And let me be the first of many to say how much your work, your books as well as your movies, have meant to me and how much real pleasure they've given me. My question is, it seems like one of the challenges facing older actresses is a lack of the kind of substantive roles that you had earlier in your careers, roles that really explore the lives of women more authentically and fully. And so I'm just curious, what roles would you still like to play? And are there any stories in your two memoirs that you think could grow into movies? Thanks so much.
Oh, boy.
That was Beth.
Well, Beth, yes. You know, honestly, I feel like I've been very fortunate with regard to that because of basically, primarily, Nancy Myers. Because Nancy Myers cast me in Something's Gotta Give. And that was a romantic comedy where I was a 56 or 57-year-old woman at that point, and it was a true romantic comedy opposite Jack Nicholson. This gave me many more opportunities. This last summer, like I was just saying, I was in a romantic comedy I appeared in, which will be opening this summer with Michael Douglas and So It Goes. And this last fall, I made a movie with Morgan Freeman, and I play his wife. And so I feel like I've had great good fortune. It's hard to find good parts for anyone at all anywhere. Mm. But at the same time, I think that I've been fortunate because I think this aspect of comedy does have more longevity for women in particular. And that's why when I was mentioning Melissa McCarthy before and Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph and, you know, a whole host of wonderful comic actresses, they seem to have more longevity. As far as a role that I would like to play, of course I would like to play someone extremely evil. Somebody who's capable of murder. Somebody who is very, very extreme. Somebody who has a physical disability.
You've never had it? You've never had that kind of role?
Never! No, and I'd still like to do, you know, a more adventurous kind of like fall down. Like, kind of like The First Wives. I think The First Wives Club was fun because we had antics and Sue, where, you know, they spent time and money to give you visual sight gags that were fun and crazy experiences. And just the more extreme, the better. That's the way I feel now. I feel like I'm ready to just get out there and be a horrible witch or anything you want me to be. I mean, I can transform
Beth,
into something
Beth,
so
thank
hideous.
You for your call. Let's bring in Nelson from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Nelson. Welcome to the show.
Did I talk too much there? I probably did.
No,
yeah,
no,
hi,
no,
Nelson.
There's a point where I'm looking for a comma or a semicolon so that I can jump in and bring in some other callers. So
come in
I found
anytime.
One.
Okay. I mean, I don't care. I like overlapping.
All right, good.
What an honor. What a thrill, Miss Keaton. You've been blessed.
I have.
My question has to do with your sense of humor and style of humor. Like, I was under the impression you were raised in a very staid, conservative family, and the zany aspect of you, was it something that initially Woody had to pry out of you and explain to you how to be his straight person on screen, or did you just, you know, automatically have the... you know, were able to express humor that had maybe been kept under wraps?
I think that regarding Woody being such a great writer and hearing the voice of women, that with Annie Hall, he basically took me and he wrote that the manner in which that I speak to this day, sort of like you, choppy. I don't complete sentences. I kind of get lost in it. It's a lot of I don't knows and, oh, yeah, well, yeah, whatever. No, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, that kind of thing on, endlessly horrible. Woody heard it and he wrote it. So he wrote me. But, you know, I've always had a sense of humor. I mean, I enjoy funny people. I think I'm a good audience. And I think that that's why I got really fortunate with Woody, was that I really love humor. I really do. And so really Woody wrote me. So that's kind of the way I see it. I think I was funny to begin with, in the sense that I remember one of the compliments that I lived and thrived on was, I had a civics teacher in high school, and he said something to me that nobody had ever said. And he said, you know, you have a sense of humor. And, you know, you hold on to certain things that people say that give you the will to carry on.
I just want to jump in on this. And speaking of Woody and the men that you've worked with, you write a lot about in the book about your relationships with the men that you've worked with and that you've had relationships with. And mm-hmm. you also make the point that they too ultimately face an age issue. And
sure.
And you even put sort of a little bit of a warning out there to some of the younger guys. You write, Tom Cruise, who turned 51 recently, is on the eve of losing his looks. Brad Pitt is 49. Johnny Depp is 50. How are they dealing with the first signs of loss? Warren Beatty, now 76, and his pal Jack Nicholson at 76 have let it go. They're over the hump. Al Pacino, too. Maybe letting go is the only graceful thing to do. Is this a conversation that you're having about being in the business where your looks are somewhat critical to your career and your income and your living? Or is this everybody?
I think it's more or less, I think everybody has to face this. Of course, if they're lucky enough to be 67 or 75 or whatever the sort of the baby boomer range, you know, which includes so many people. I feel like I think that's such a hard question to answer, because all those people are doing very well. You know, that I'm talking about in the book, mm-hmm. because they're exceptionally gifted with very specific gifts. They're great actors, or they're fantastic writers, or they're brilliant producers, or they're singers. And those people, you know, are unusual, and they're
but
the
their
exception.
Career, but do,
in
but do
terms
their careers
of,
do their careers depend on their looks?
No, okay. I don't think so.
So in a sense,
no.
It doesn't
I mean,
matter.
Did Steven Spielberg's career depend on his looks? I don't think so. I don't think everybody. No. Mm-mm.
I'm really curious about something you wrote about Jack Nicholson. You did not have a romantic relationship with Jack Nicholson. I'm only reporting that because you reported in the book. But you have a real friendship with him, and you wrote this letter to him that I want to. And you report it in the book, and I want to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
You say, mm-hmm. you wrote the following to him. You are not a person who resides in the world of right and wrong. You are not bound by moral platitudes. Your authenticity has been earned by the choices you've made, and these choices show on your face. Your face, your great face, challenges standardization. Looking at you for as long as I have has made it easy for me to come to the conclusion that your face is the best face I've ever seen, not only because you're pretty, and you are pretty, Jack, but mainly because over the years, your face has morphed into something magnificent. What is...
Oh, can I just
Jack
stop
Nicholson
for a second?
Thing?
No, I have to review your reading. I just thought that was beautiful, the way you read it. So
yeah,
simple,
it was,
so direct.
Actually,
and it
yeah.
makes me... Yes. So you have a career here.
Finally.
You can read.
Finally discovered.
No. I love him. It's hard not to love Jack Nicholson.
Talk about
and
the face, though. That's so... There. I've never heard
that face. Oh, I love that face. But then, you know, I like Barack Obama's face, too. Because, you know, I think of Barack Obama's face as a face that has... He has two faces. He has a face that bears the weight of the responsibility of the job that he has. But then when he smiles, oh, my God. God, it's like a blast of light. It's like he's a boy. It's just a radiant smile. It's a gift beyond gifts. And, you know, that's a magnificent face.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you agree? I mean, that smile is irresistible to me.
Let's bring in Juan from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Juan. You're on Point.
Oh, my God. What a Pleasure to be able to. First of all, hi, John. Hi, Ben.
Hi, and Diane Keaton's here too, so that should be pretty thrilling for you.
Yes, of course, both of you. And well, I've been watching Diane's movies for many years, since I was probably, I'm 50 now. But I want to share with you, Diane, that my daughter, Isabella, and I
Isabella,
we watch your movies over and over, and when we are selecting movies, if Diane Keaton is in the movie, we're going to watch. We found you, I think your comedies and the two movies that we watch over and over, we have CDs, is Something Gotta Give and I Told You So. And, you know, my daughter was probably 10 the first time she saw your movies. She's now 20, and we still have that same, you know, I think your audience is also aging, and you look better every day. So, I mean, I...
Juan, what do you really think? I'm gonna let Diane respond to that. Thanks.
Juan, you're beautiful. No, I just want to hear him talk to me. What do I have to say? More. No. Juan, your enthusiasm and your exuberance, oh, my goodness. I don't know what to say. Oh, I feel like you're talking about somebody else, somebody I'd like to know.
Why do you hide in clothing, Diane Keaton? And I'm quoting you again. I wear hats that hide the head, the gloves that hide the fingers, the long sleeve turtlenecks that hide both the arms and the neck, the leggings that hide the legs, and the boots that hide the feet. Why do you hide?
Because I think that it frames my body in a fashion that I find attractive. And also, it's
different from hiding.
Shield.
Framing is different from hiding.
But it's also part of it, because there is something there. There's the essence of a head, and some hands. I mean, what do you want? That's enough.
And eyes.
I mean, seriously, I'm serious.
Why are you so hard on your own eyes? This is a theme that comes up
again and again in the
book.
Well, I'm so appreciative. It's a one hand. It's a two handed situation with the eyes, because it's how they look. But then it's also how they see. So I'm grateful for the gift of seeing. But these eyes are my father's eyes. So I carry my father with me, and I'm proud of that as well.
Well, for people who aren't picturing you with the photograph right now, why don't you like your eyes?
But let me just say something, okay? Uh-huh. Let's say you're Kate Moss.
I'm Kate Moss.
Okay? And you're Kate Moss, and you are, you know, one of the world's greatest beauties. That's Kate Moss for you. And Kate Moss, I believe, gets up every morning, even when she was a girl, even when she was 18, even now, even in the beginning, I believe that she looks in the mirror and she sees all the flaws. She sees them just like I see mine and just like you see yours. Now, how long does she linger on it is the question. Less than me, more than likely. But my whole thing is I have created for myself, in terms of how I dress, something that I like. And that just is what the book is about. It's about make your own beauty. How do you see beauty? For me, I prefer clothes as a fortress.
And the book is called Let's Just Say It Wasn't Pretty, and only time limits this conversation, and we are out of it now. I want to thank you very much, Diane Keaton, for joining us.
Thank you.
On Point.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we will remember poet Maya Angelou. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Maya Angelou died yesterday. Her passing was anything but the silencing of her voice. She just left too much good writing behind. And you're seeing excerpts of that all over the internet today and her picture on the front page of the paper. And that is what happens when words can really travel. And hers traveled in time, too, touching millions of people who never met her. That may well include you. And it does include our next two guests who have gone to very different places in the world, but they share this, hearing the truth in the language of Maya Angelou. Last year in an interview, Oprah asked Maya Angelou to recount the best advice she had ever given. And after she thought about it for a moment, Angelou said it was that which she gave to her young son years earlier. He came to her and he wanted to know, how do I get friends?
I told him two things. I told him, in order to get a friend, you have to be a friend. Be ready to be a friend. And also, I told him, there's a place in you that you must keep inviolate. You must keep it pristine, clean, so that nobody has the right to curse you or treat you badly. Nobody, no mother, father, no wife, no husband, nobody. Because that may be the place you go to when you meet God.
Joining me now from Chicago is Elsie Granderson. He is a contributor to CNN and a senior writer for ESPN. And yesterday, his article caught our eye. He wrote a piece called How Maya Angelou Gave Me Life. It was on CNN's website. And Elsie, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much, John, for having me.
Elsie, what did you hear in what you just heard? And more importantly, the reason we wanted to bring you on, how did Maya Angelou give you life?
Well, how long is the show? you know, it's absolutely amazing listening to her response. And as soon as she said, in order to get a friend, you need to be a friend, asking myself, how did I miss that one? You know, there are so many great quotes, great lines, great thoughts that she shared in her 86 years. And I'm finding the joy, even through my sorrow, I'm finding the joy in that I'm just discovering all these new treats. So it's almost as if she never left. And so listening to the interview was a reminder of how she lives on.
One thing you said was that her words for you were company when you felt alone and a lit candle in the dark, which is it means that she was there when you were down, when you had a need.
Absolutely. The periods in which I needed her most were the periods in which I was wrestling with coming out and embracing my sexual orientation. And, you know, as I was going through this process, I was living in a very conservative part of the country. And so it wasn't as if I was in New York or LA or San Francisco wrestling with these questions. I felt pretty isolated. And so it was, you know, through her poetry, particularly Still I Rise, that really, when I was feeling really alone, that I turned to help me push forward until I got to the place where I could find a larger, more tangible community.
Also joining us today from Atlanta, Georgia, is Isabel Wilkerson. And Isabel Wilkerson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and she's author of the recent bestseller, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Isabel, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, great to be here.
Let's listen to this now. One of Maya Angelou's most remembered moments was in January of 1993 when she delivered the inaugural poem On the Pulse of the Morning. This was at the swearing-in of President Bill Clinton.
Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. But if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings.
And Isabel Wilkerson, the reason that we asked you onto the broadcast is because you're an historian, and what we wanted to ask you to do, hearing that and knowing of the body of work, did Maya Angelou break through the way she did because of her individual story primarily, or because of a sense that she was an emblem of others?
Well, I think it was both. I mean, the 20th century unfolds through her life, from depression, the Great Depression, to wars, to the Jim Crow era, to the Great Migration, to the Civil Rights Movement, and that moment where she was delivering the poem for the country to hear at that moment. and then to the election of the first African-American president. I mean, her life itself was an epic poem, and through her words and through her incredible life, I mean, her life went exposed us to what it took to survive all that she did. You know, she was a poet, she was a memoirist, she was a dancer, she was an actress, she was an activist, she was a film director and a teacher, and then she had that deep vibrato and that wisdom of a, basically of almost like a Southern preacher. So she was bigger than any of the individual things that she did, and she came to represent the country through these difficult times.
Take us through a little bit of the personal history, just a little bit of her childhood, and in a sense how it relates to the work that you're known for, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration.
Well, she was born in St. Louis. She was a child of the Great Migration because her father had migrated there from Arkansas. Her parents' marriage didn't last, and then she was sent to live with her father's mother in Stamps, Arkansas, where she was just 3 years old and where she grew up essentially in the hardest years of Jim Crow. Her grandmother loved her deeply, but she was back and forth between her parents. And then when she was 8 years old, returned to her mother, she was raped. And that man, the man who raped her, was then killed by her uncles. And as a result of her own blaming of herself for all that she'd gone through, she was mute for 5 years. So this grand, amazing voice of the 20th century was silenced when she was a child, essentially. And during that time, she was a great observer of all that was around her, and she quickened her memory in order to observe all that was going on, and she read a lot of poetry and just was inside herself,
and how,
and it all came out.
How then does somebody whose story is actually so detailed, so many unique, distinct twists and turns, so particular to herself, become, how does she become a voice for generations, not just one, but multiple generations?
I think that she was incredibly self-aware of all that she was going through during the quiet years of her youth. And she then lived so much of what all of us can only even begin to imagine. I mean, having been a calypso singer, a calypso dancer, and raising her son alone, she was a single mother at age 17. She traveled all over this country in search of ways to raise him. She traveled outside of the country. She went to Cairo, London. She lived in Ghana. I mean, she was all over the world. And she also intersected with so many of the great names of the 20th century. She personally knew James Baldwin. She knew Malcolm X. She performed on stage with Cicely Tyson and James Earl Jones. She knew these people. She was, in some ways, living the lives that so many other people were living, and, on a larger scale.
And yet, L.Z. Granderson, she did not know you personally. You never met.
Correct.
Do you mind? Does it matter, actually, since it's the words that connect?
Yes, because there's a yearning in me to tell her thank you and see her eyes and let her know what her work has meant to me throughout my life.
If she were here, what would you say?
Last line of the piece that I wrote, which is "Thank you, dear friend." She was my friend, even though we had never met, because it just seemed as if she knew where I was at each step of my journey. And even in her passing, again, as I said earlier, discovering these thoughts, these words, these prose that I hadn't seen before, it's like she's continuing to teach me, as she's taught so many of us, about life and joy and struggle and courage. I struggle as a writer to be able to properly frame what she has done for me through words.
That's interesting. It's beyond your capacity as a writer to get to it, you think? It's that deep.
I'm embarrassed by that, because this is what I do for a living, right? I'm supposed to be able to paint the world around us through words. And yet when I think about that day in class and having to read Phenomenal Woman out loud and struggling with my sexual orientation and struggling with what it means to be a man and being too afraid to say, "Phenomenal Woman, that's me," and what I learned about myself just through that struggle to getting to the point in which I can say that on NPR, it's a very, very personal and hard to describe journey.
I feel I can hear the emotion in your voice now, even as you talk about it. Let's bring in Sean from Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Sean. Welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
I found Maya Angelou to be very, of course, like everyone else, inspirational. As a young gay man growing in a very rural community, it was difficult to attend in school. And eventually I did quit and get my GED. But the most important thing was I spoke at the graduation of the GED. I had went to class with women from the age of, 60, 70 years old to, as young as myself. And I read a poem that she'd written about stepping off the path, that if the path forward was not, navigable and there was no, way to go back down the path you came, that you just step off in life and cut your own path. And everyone in that room at that graduation had done that very thing. She carried me through a lot of very difficult times and a lot of adversity, being a gay man, it's not like everyone in your family is, so you do feel alone. And with Maya Angelou, I felt very comforted. I felt like she understood how cruel but how kind the world could be.
Sean, thanks.
She really taught me not to be angry.
Sean, thanks very much for sharing that. I want to ask Isabel Wilkerson, you have the historian's perspective on this. Writers have their time, and then when the writers fade from the scene, very often their words become less relevant or less part of the conversation. There are a few exceptions here and there, maybe Shakespeare in the English language, maybe Charles Dickens, a few others, but most people don't tend not to outlive the decades in which they've lived themselves. Do you think it's going to be different with Maya Angelou, or do we just not know?
I do. I think that she'll be known for the totality of her life. And because she intersected with so much of what it means to be human, she lived the turmoil for us, and then she interpreted it, and then she grew from it, and then she taught us what to learn from that, which is essentially she wrote and spoke and lived her life about love. And, love of humanity, love of one's own spirit, love of one's people, and how that love can lead to the freedom that everyone seeks. I mean, she's known for I know why the caged bird sings, and she said that the caged bird sings of freedom. The caged bird sings of freedom, and she knew what it meant to be that caged bird, and she thus speaks for everyone who ever felt limited and restricted and not being able to be all that they were meant to be. And she lived it and then wrote about it. And I think that it will prevail and will live on.
And LZ, I kind of want to put the same question to you, her lasting ability, her ability to last, to endure, to be in 50 years somebody whose poetry we're reading. Do you think she's in that circle?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, part of the reason why is because her words were so transcendent, and they didn't just represent one particular group of people or one particular struggle. They represented the struggle of the human condition. Mm-hmm. And so as we continue to move forward in terms of civil rights for everyone, in terms of equality for everyone, whether it be income equality, housing equality, marriage equality, whatever that equality struggle is, her voice will provide the soundtrack for which we will march to, because she was able to tap into the human condition in such a unifying way.
Well, it's very, very powerful to hear two people who unfortunately both did not meet Maya Angelou, nevertheless talk how deeply they were touched by her, which is the theme that we were looking for. And thank you also to Sean for calling in. I want to thank you, LZ Granderson. You're a contributor to CNN and a senior writer at ESPN. LZ, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
And Isabel Wilkerson is author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Isabel, great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
And we are going to give the last word to Maya Angelou herself, reciting the words of her iconic poem, Still I Rise, originally published in 1978.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh. Does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
Maya Angelou reading her poem, Still I Rise. She died yesterday at 86. Her words, they live. You can hear more of Angelou's work and a conversation with her at On Point at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.